You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We have a very serious problem of confidence, mutual lack of confidence, which we need to address, and we hope that this process will remedy some of that.
Lausanne, where diplomats negotiating with Iran are still trying to think of ways to make the word elusive sound optimistic. Nina Schick and James Boyes are here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including here in the UK, a nation is brushing up its 140 character insults before settling down to watch the only leaders' debate of the current election campaign. We'll be seeing if we can remember the names of all seven contenders. An agreement between Russia and Ukraine on gas sales. Could it lead to agreement on more besides? Amnesty's annual capital punishment report, fewer people are being executed, but more are being sentenced to death, and a new poll revealing that Russians are falling in love with Stalin, this time voluntarily. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the programme. My guests today are Nina Schick from the think tank Open Europe and the historian and academic James Boyes, author of the new book Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both back to Midori House, and we will start in Lausanne, where not for the first time Iran have been spending the last couple of weeks playing Lucy Van Pelt to the international community's Charlie Brown, once again feigning cooperation only to swish it away at the last second. The deadline for a preliminary agreement about Tehran's nuclear programme passed 2 days ago. Talks have continued. According to Javid Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, this is in the last few minutes, somewhat annoyingly. It's almost as if the whole thing is a conspiracy to completely undermine my cue writing. Found solutions, he has tweeted, ready to begin drafting immediately. Now, that has to sound hopeful. There is also some suggestion around that from reports inside the talks that the agreement will basically agree to kick this down the road until June the 30th, which was supposed to be the final deadline for a final agreement. Nina, I know we are kind of flying in the dark a little bit here because of this exceedingly inconveniently timed statement which they're about to make. After all this disappointment, after all this wrangling, this has been going on for more than a decade. Is it reasonable to be at all optimistic at this point?
I think that the talk could still go either way. So I think there's still a 50-50% chance. I think these negotiations will be seen as historic, either for agreeing to something comprehensive and signing it off, or for being the moment when these talks actually failed. I think I agree with you that this announcement is just going to kick it down the road to the end of June, the 30th of June, because critical details have still not been agreed on. And those are the technical details that are going to be very important. Those are indeed the details that the US Congress is going to be looking at when they have their vote on possible further sanctions on Iran coming up on the 14th of April.
James, one thing we do still know is that June the 30th is the deadline by which this is supposed to be done, dusted. Agreements signed between Iran and the rest of the world, this issue put to bed, the absolutely extraordinary nightmare of a Middle East nuclear arms race, hopefully postponed for a very, very, very long time. What if that doesn't happen by the June the 30th?
Well, that's the great question, isn't it? I mean, you think about how long it is that the United States and Iran has been in this sort of state of stalemate. I can't honestly believe that if it doesn't get to the 30th of June and there's nothing in place, that they won't be able to move it down the line and continue a conversation with regard to this, quite frankly. We have a situation, I think, whereby there is great animosity and antagonism and suspicion on both sides with regard to this deal. Within the United States, you're seeing an awful lot of pushback from Capitol Hill against this. Nobody quite knows what the form is going to emerge from this. Philip Hammond has said recently, this might not even take a physical form. It might be almost a verbal agreement. That's going to be very, very difficult for many people on Capitol Hill to live with on the basis of how do you hold a regime in Tehran to something which has not been committed to paper? So it's going to be fascinating to see what comes out in the next couple of minutes with regard to the announcement we're expecting, and to see if anything tangible comes out of this at all at this rate.
Nina, how much of what happens with this process up till June the 30th and after it is going to be governed by factors external to the talks, which are the obvious irreducible fact that President Barack Obama will be leaving office, which, and you would think he has to represent the best chance the Iranians are likely to get for a deal amenable to them. There's the increasing gathering rumours about the health of the Iranian Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei. And there's also the fact that they have to factor in the fact that, like it or not, Benjamin Netanyahu will be the Prime Minister of Israel for the foreseeable future. Might it be sort of, I guess, again, I'm attempting optimism, which is possibly somewhat foolish at this juncture. Might everybody have realised that there is, for various reasons, a now or never aspect to this?
Well, I think James is correct in pointing out that even if that 30th June deadline isn't met, that what will happen is that more talks will continue in some way or another. I think the broad aim here is to kind of prevent Iran from being able to create a nuclear weapon within a couple of months, as it would be able to do now, to a more feasible timeline of about a year, allowing other U.S. allies in the region, such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt, to also develop their own nuclear capacities. But I don't think that if that 30th of June deadline isn't met and a framework isn't set in place, that these talks are then over.
I think one of the great problems here, and I think we've discussed this with yourself in the past, with maybe relation to other issues, is that the American domestic political framework creates what you could see as an artificial timeline for the need to get things done. I mean, we often hear talk about US grand strategy, but how do you possibly devise a grand strategy in a time frame wherein which you have 2 year cycles for an American election system? Everybody knows Obama's going to be out of office come January 2017, and a new administration taking over. So if you can't get anything done within the next 6 months, you suddenly hit New Hampshire, Iowa, and the whole primary season, during which everybody's focus will turn away from Obama towards Hillary, Jeb. You know, you hear people like Lindsey Graham, for example, John McCain, talking about the need to get this done, the idea that even if you have an agreement in place, it's going to have to struggle to get through the Senate. So I think one of the problems here is the administration in Washington has set what many people believe to be an artificial timeline for success, predicated upon the idea that they know the timescales and the time frame they've got to deal with in Washington, which is artificial itself.
Okay, well, we will doubtless be discussing today's developments on other programs on Monocle 24 this week, very probably, I suspect, on the Daily later tonight at 2200 London time. For the moment, we will stick with the theme of mutually hostile and suspicious leaders gathered beneath one roof. Tonight in the UK, viewers who can stand it will be treated to the only televised debate of the current general election, due mostly to the reluctance of Prime Minister David Cameron to engage with his primary opponent, Ed Miliband of the Labour Party, and his coalition partner, Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrats. Tonight will be a seven-way contest, including the leaders of four minor parties. Nina, is there any way imaginable that this won't be ridiculous?
No, I think it's going to be absolutely ridiculous. There's not going to be much time for any policy substance. So first of all, the leaders have a short amount of time to make a statement. Then there'll be four topics which they'll be able to discuss, not in a great amount of detail. And then they'll be able to make closing statements. So no, I don't think it will be anything short of ridiculous. And I think that it's interesting for Cameron, who's, of course, the incumbent and, you know, trying to return to office. This has actually played out quite well, because what he didn't want was to share a TV debate with Miliband and UKIP's Nigel Farage. And now that there's all seven leaders, you know, that kind of buffers him a little bit. So I think it's gone okay from the perspective of Cameron.
Yeah, for at least three of those leaders, I think when they're opened up to follow-up questions, the first one is going to be, who are you again? James, does it just seem that the debate culture, if you like, will never quite entrench in the UK? Because it is a new thing. 2010 was the first time this had been done, and it only happened because Gordon Brown agreed to it because he thought at that point he had absolutely nothing to lose. Is there something about Britain that just won't revere the process like the Americans have come to?
I don't think so. I think the difference here you've got is that in the United States, there is a process behind which this can happen. We were talking before we came on air. This has not been something which has been universally adopted since Kennedy debated Nixon. It's something which there has been stops. There wasn't one in 64. There wasn't one in 68. There wasn't one in 72. And quite frankly, if you're the incumbent and you're ahead, don't debate. Because all it does is it raises the stature of the challengers. You put them on the same stage as the prime minister in this case. Tonight's debate will actually be less like a presidential debate that we've seen in the US and far more like the debates that you see between candidates of the same party at a primary level in the United States, where we've seen events like this occur before with a whole load of pygmies desperately trying to come out on top, effectively.
A perhaps literal seven dwarves.
Absolutely.
In this particular case. Do we have any idea, Nina, because this is something that I have looked into and I cannot come up with a good answer for it. The Democratic Unionist Party were not invited to this, who have eight members in the House of Commons, which is more than four of the parties whose leaders are attending. If we're going to make a mockery of the process by inviting seven leaders, why not make a mockery of it by inviting eight?
Yes, I mean, they definitely should have been invited, but they haven't been. So I don't exactly know why, because they actually might be essential for Cameron, because they're one of the parties who might help prop up a minority Conservative government if David Cameron is to become Prime Minister again, if he has just a minority in the new Parliament. So I don't actually know why they're not there. But again, I would emphasize that I think it'll be a bit of a farce, because there isn't much time to get to any substance of policy. And as for the four big topics that we might see discussed today, I bet you immigration will be one of them.
Really? There's a controversial statement there from Nina James. Do you think it'll come up?
In regard to your aunt's question, it's possible they couldn't find a stage big enough. I was just wondering. What I will say is this. The thing to watch out for tonight is mistakes. It's a great opportunity to succeed, but it's a huge opportunity to fall flat on your face. Governor Perry, four years ago, famously forgot his own policies. Let's not forget Ed Miliband didn't mention his own policies in his speech to the Labour Party not so long ago.
It's not quite the same as forgetting how to count to three, which is what Perry did.
That's very true. Yeah, Gerald Ford, of course, in the 70s told the Americans there was no Soviet domination of Central and Eastern Europe. So, you know, this really is an opportunity to fall flat on your face. So it make great roadkill watching, I think.
Do you think, though, Nina, it actually makes a difference to the election campaign? Is it going to... Well, actually, I suppose I'm just thinking out loud. It can, because in 2010, in 2010, it seemed to, whereas all of a sudden, Nick Clegg was put on an equal footing with the two bigger leaders, and a lot of people who watched it thought, he seems quite nice. I like him. He seems a reasonable chap, which by all accounts he is. And you had that brief bizarre phenomenon known as Cleggmania, although I'm informed that within the party it was actually known as Cleggstacy. But this, of course, this of course did not translate at all to MPs in the final election. In fact, they actually came out of that with fewer than they went in with. Do these things make any actual difference?
Well, I think so. I mean, and for the smaller parties, you know, it's a much coveted public platform, which they wouldn't necessarily have had otherwise. So I think it's important for them. And the other interesting thing is that the bookies are putting their money on Farage to win. And of course, UKIP has been doing a little bit worse in the polls recently. So this might be the chance, given his previous experience, you know, in public debating when he took on Nick Clegg, for example, on the EU. That gave him a big boost. And I think he might be the winner tonight.
UKIP, we should explain to our foreign listeners who may not be acquainted with them, are probably best thought of as the militant wing of a Surrey golf club. Nigel Farage is a charismatic and plausible and entertaining figure. This kind of thing, though, rather worryingly, is just made for him, isn't it? Because he doesn't really have any responsibility. He's never going to wield any real power. He can go out there and promise the proverbial moon on a stick, conjure up whatever nonsense about immigration he likes. And no one's going to have time to correct him, are they?
You're absolutely right, Andrew. And again, to answer that point and your initial question, the idea about why it is that Clegg's success at the last debate didn't translate, I think, into success for the Liberal Democrats is partly because of the difference between the US and the UK model. When you talk about debates in the US, you are seeing the people you will vote for specifically. Here in the UK, they act as the representative of their party. So they are not the people you'll go out and vote for unless you live in the those particular constituents. Here again, you have the problem with regard to Farage, and I equate him to the idea of putting some clown like Russell Brand on Question Time.
Don't tempt
it's far
fate.
Too
no, that's happened.
It's far too simple to take a comedian or someone without any possible responsibility, put them on a platform with responsible politicians, and they can come out with simplistic populist answers that they have not got any responsibility to deliver upon. And Farage, I think, is going to be able to do that tonight. He's going to take, you know, this very sort of populist, everyman approach, stick it in the face of the Prime Minister in particular, and come across probably very, very well to the man on the street, but he'll have no responsibility to deliver upon anything he says tonight.
If we're both agreed, then, that this whole thing is a monumental and farcical waste of every time, will we all be watching?
Yeah.
Absolutely, because why not? It's the best show in town.
Okay, well, on that thought, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are James Boyce and Nina Schick, and they will indeed still be here when we return. Up next, Ukraine, the present and future of capital punishment, and why killing millions of your own people won't stop the survivors from admiring you.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today he is still in charge at Café de l'Ombre, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior Style in Japan, premiering now in the film section on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, the historian and academic James Boyce and Nina Schick from Open Europe. Now, earlier this week, Amnesty International released its annual report on the uses and abuses of the death penalty. It makes, as usual, grim reading. At least 607 people, and certainly many more, there being no official figures for China and North Korea, were executed worldwide in 2014. Nearly 20,000 more were believed to be under capital sentence. The report noted a trend of governments around the world brandishing the rope in response to real and imaginary threats to state security and public safety. Nina, first of all, there's a weird contradiction or apparent contradiction in the report in that fewer people were actually executed, as far as we know, in 2014. China and North Korea obviously could skew the statistics massively. Down on the previous year, but more people are being sentenced to death. Does that tell us anything?
Well, I think the interesting thing about this report is that when, especially in our line of work, when one considers what's happening in the world, it seems that it's increasingly becoming a more dangerous place when you consider some of the crises that are going on and, you know, things like this. And as somebody who studies, who obviously follows the EU and EU policy, it's very interesting from the EU's perspective when you see them making foreign policy speeches, big leaders like Merkel and Hollande, etc. This is a line that often comes out, that we're, you know, living in a more dangerous world, and as the EU's influence is waning, that this is, you know, our ideas of democracy and Western, you know, the right, human rights, etc., need to be spread out across the world. So I don't know. It makes depressing reading, but I don't really know what else.
Just staying on that, the EU is by and large, the EU is now entirely abolitionist, isn't it?
Yes.
But I'm just wondering as whether or not the same trend exists in the rest of the EU as does here in the UK, and that poll after poll here in the UK actually continues to find a reasonable majority of people in favour of capital punishment.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you have more right-wing parties spreading up across the EU with the, you know, the more central moderate parties splintering. This is something that we see across Europe. And parties like Front National in France, you know, polling at 25%, they also want to bring back the death penalty. So that's a phenomenon that we see across Europe, not just here in the UK.
James, is that the reason then, in the US being your particular specialty, that sure. It remains as popular as it does in the US? Because looking at the report, and again, we don't know about China and North Korea, though I think we can probably safely assume that if we had the figures, they would be leading the table. But of the countries which we do have figures, you have Iran miles in front, followed by Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and then the United States of America. Mm. Why isn't the US more worried about being part of that club?
I don't think it's a club that it obviously wants to be associated with, but I think ultimately that far too few people recognize the kind of frontier mentality that still exists in the United States. Don't forget, it's still a relatively young country. This is a nation which, it comes from a frontier approach. It's still got an awful lot of wilderness associated with it. There is still a lot of people call it a gun culture, but the idea that, you know, there is still this idea that, you are there to defend oneself. And a sense, I think, that, you know, an eye-to-an-eye mentality very much prevails over there. Now, whether that's due to certain religious perspectives which are adhered to in certain parts of the country, don't forget this is not a nationwide phenomenon, of course. There are certain parts of the country which have a far greater affiliation with regard to the death penalty, as well as other parts of the country which are quite repelled by it. And it's also a situation whereby, because there is a state-by-state approach to this, you know, you can see certain underlying trends depending upon who's in power and what the prevailing consensus is at that time. But there's no doubt, I think, that within the United States, there is a very different approach to this than we would say here in the United Kingdom, despite the many similarities between Britain and America.
Nina, for all that, the Amnesty report says it still thinks the worldwide trend is towards abolition. Is that Amnesty being optimistic, or does that appear to be the case, do you think?
Well, it's difficult to quantify if you don't have the actual numbers for the entire world. So I can't. If that's what Amnesty says, then we can optimistically hope that that might be true. But again, as I mentioned, without the actual figures, how can one quantify that?
Okay, well, let's look now at the Ukraine. I just did that thing of calling it the Ukraine. It annoys the heck out of me when other people do it. Apologies, profoundly. Let's look now at Ukraine and Russia. Actually, I'll even it up. I said, let's look now at Ukraine and the Russia. Though they are, despite Moscow's earnest declarations to the contrary, more or less at war, they're still more or less obliged to do business with each other. Ukraine has today signed an interim deal with Russia for cheaper gas for the next 3 months, presumably because Russia wouldn't want anyone being cold while they're being invaded. James, is this good news?
Who's it good news for?
I've read this story upside down and backwards and can't tell whether we're supposed to be pleased about it or not.
I couldn't agree more with you. I'm so glad you've come in to save me. I was thinking the same thing. I mean, ultimately, you know, where else is Ukraine going to go? The gas is going to come from Russia. Russia isn't going to basically sit back and let Ukraine go closer to Europe and get gas from that direction, one would imagine. So the idea that there is going to be some sort of trade agreement between these two essentially warring nations is one thing. The idea that that Ukraine can pay less for it than it has been doing previously is all well and good. Of course, it's important to recognize we are heading into the summer months when presumably the need for gas is somewhat reduced. Just in terms of heating bills, and it might have been during the winter. It'll be interesting to see whether there's a quid pro quo agreement of this nature when it gets cold in the autumn.
Yeah, Putin has said that further decisions will depend on the price of oil. Nina, is this Russia trying maybe to be a little bit conciliatory?
No, there's not much to be read into the price. There's just not much to be read into the price change. It was always going to come down with the changing of the seasons. A gas deal in the winter is very different from a gas deal in the spring. And as Putin correctly mentioned, it does depend on the global oil price as well, which is of course tied to the gas price. It'll be interesting to see whether or not Ukraine will try perhaps now having a lower price to stockpile some gas for the coming months, because we don't know what will happen next winter. But given that they have to prepay for everything, that's probably unlikely to happen. So they're very much still in the clutches of Putin when it comes to their energy needs.
Is it just Putin then trying to lock in customers before the gas price falls even further?
Yes.
Oh, I was trying for a good news story tonight. But as long as we're being pessimistic, we will stay with Russia and its leader, because foreign observers baffled as to how Vladimir Putin has turned a tanking economy and semi-pariah status into 80% approval ratings probably need to consider the benchmark from which he operates. A recent poll has discovered that a third of Russians respect Joseph Stalin, and nearly half believe that his terror was justified, a figure all the more astonishing when you consider how many Russians must have lost ancestors to his lunacy. James, this figure is not only bizarre in and of itself, it's actually increased fairly dramatically in the last few years. Why?
To give you a specific answer about why that is going to be rather challenging. However, what I will say is that throughout the post-Cold War era, there has always been this rather troubling reflection back to the good old days of Uncle Joe Stalin. I think a lot of this has to do with diminishing Russian national pride, the idea that the former Soviet Union has been dissolved, and what you saw is a hankering back to the good old days. You know, relatively few people now alive, I would imagine, will remember the purges of the Stalin era. And as a result of that, you know, there is an easy way to look back and say, well, at least he had, you know, he kept the Soviet Union strong. There was bread in the shops. Trains ran on time, and people feared the Soviet Union. And you can clearly see what it is that Putin is trying to tap into with regard to that sort of latent Soviet nationalism, which is never far away, and which is revealed every time you see people walking through Red Square carrying these large banners of Stalin. It's been going on, you know, pretty much underreported in many ways, I think, since even the days of Yeltsin. I remember doing some work on Clinton back then in 96, for example, and it was a problem then. It's become a problem even since. You know, you look at Robert Harris was writing about this back in the 90s, for example, in his book Archangel, the idea that, you know, you have a historic figure of epic proportions who killed far more people than Hitler could have ever dreamt of, quite frankly, who we were allied with. And I think one of the reasons that the true horrors of Stalin are unreported in the West to the extent that they could have been is because there is a national embarrassment about the fact that we were allied with him. But within the Soviet, with the Russian system now, he clearly is the last strong man to reach back to for obviously ill reason.
I remember a few years ago interviewing the historian Anthony Beaver about his book about the Red Army's assault on Germany in the closing days of World War II, and this topic came up, and he said he thought it was because amid the relentless misery and horror of Russian history, they have this one shining hour, which was their victory in the Great Patriotic War, as they call it, achieved with, you know, no small amount of courage, resource, and extraordinary sacrifice. And it's very hard for themselves to detach from the leader who led them to that triumph. Do you think it is as simple as that, Nina?
Oh, absolutely. I think I think that certainly plays a role in it. I think the kind of particularly boisterous brand of nationalism that Putin has been unleashing in Russia recently also, you know, really taps into that sentiment of fighting against the fascists, you know, which is what they call,
the
forces in eastern Ukraine. So it certainly has a historical link about the Soviet Union fighting against Nazi Germany. And I also think it's, as James correctly pointed out, you know, there have been people on Russia's right who have been supportive of Stalin over a long period of time, but it certainly coincides with what recent geopolitical and developments in Ukraine that Stalin's popularity has increased now. I think it was up 25% in the last 3 years.
Extraordinarily so. Is there anything we can learn from this, or that the EU could learn from this, about how to deal with Russia and with Putin?
Well, they've made an extraordinary mess of it. I mean, in the very beginning, I keep saying this whenever I'm asked about the current Ukraine crisis, you know, in the very, very beginning, the EU miscalculated. I mean, they only needed to study Russian history for 10 minutes to realize that what happens in Ukraine is far more important to Russia than it ever will be to the EU. And by giving Ukraine a binary choice between either, you know, becoming closer to the EU or Russia, giving them an all or nothing choice. They've played a lot in the way the current situation has happened.
Nina Schick and James Boyes, we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much both for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Stefano Fumagalli and Sarah Monetta, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Marcus Hippie will be here keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck follows at 1900, and at 2200 I'll be back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. I'll also be back with this show at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.